The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
All right, let's begin. Somebody, I guess you want to read the case.
Yes. Rujing. Rujing studied with Zen Master Zhijian. Zhijian asked him, "How can you purify what has never been defiled?" After more than a year, Rujing was suddenly awakened and said, "I've hit upon that which is undefiled." Should I continue?
Now, let me just say that the way this is framed is the most like a traditional koan that we've gotten in the in any of these stories, because it's the master asks him a question, and here it says the master spent more than a year on this question, and then suddenly he's awakened. So here you have essentially the Dogen's teacher, this great Soto patriarch, being awakened through working on a koan. Right? And it's, how can something that has never been soiled be clean? Like many koans, it poses a basic dichotomy between clean and soiled here. And since most of our practice, most of the way we organize ourselves psychologically is trying to get from a defiled to a preferred side of some dualism. The koan asks, is there some way out of this either or? Right? It's it's not just asking how can something that's been soiled be cleaned, it's how can something that's never been soiled be cleaned. Okay? Mm-hmm. You, the whole metaphor of cleaning or purification would have been, fundamental to that whole religious framework of practice. Practice was a matter of purification in some sense, and the language of purification is included in all sorts of chants and rituals. Sort of analogous to the notion of merit. So the teacher challenges the conventional wisdom of what we're doing here is somehow purifying what is originally defiled. How can you clean something that isn't dirty? We could also say, how do you fix something that isn't broken? That would be more our language now, right? And in all these cases, what does it mean to answer that, right? Somehow one is confronted with the sort of psychological reality that you are treating yourself as broken or defiled or damaged or in need of improvement. And some way trying to see how is practice a challenge to that assumption rather than a solution to the conventional problem. That's the basic issue involved. Anybody want to say anything about that, or should we?
I hear that, like, yes, we should start from where we are, but and have this, you know, I think it's comforting to hear that we are all perfect, that is nothing lucky, nothing, you know, that's it. But then we have all the problems and confusions and complications that can torment us and others. So I feel that sometimes this can become kind of a comforting type of expression that maybe take us off the hook.
Well, it's being told you're perfect as you are rarely provides much more than a very temporary anodyne.
Rujing's also not saying don't clean the toilet.
Yes, he was the, he was the master of toilets.
I missed that.
A little bit of historical fun behind the metaphor. So his job in the monastery was toilet cleaner. And so he was every day involved in cleaning what was dirty, right? And so this is, or not, right? Right, so that's sort of the other way of challenging the dichotomy.
I think that's important to include, just so it remains challenging, that this, you know, like, still clean, but how do you clean something that was never dirty? What do you call cleaning? Like, all these...
Mm. Right, so it's... you know, one way of framing that would be to say, the shit isn't in some way dirty or contaminating, yet still we want to clean up the toilets, right? No, you don't...
You don't purify the shit.
Right.
It just has its own place. But how does that translate into psychology, or like the way we treat others, or
well, the way we treat our anxiety or anger or sexuality?
But when he gives this answer, how does he say it? I've hit upon that which is undefiled. It seems like kind of a problem, because it seems implicit in that what he's looking for is there is some one thing that is undefiled,
well,
rather than
it's a problem.
The whole image of defiled and undefiled is.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, and that's the question: whether he's there's sort of a trap in whether you sort of think that. The way out of this dichotomy between pure and defiled, what needs to be clean, what is soiled, is that you've hit upon some original undefilable purity, right? And that's exempt from cleaning because it can't be soiled, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this kind of well, what would that be? It would be like a pristine state of consciousness, mm-hmm. right? Of absolute clarity, right? Of what? I mean,
I kind of wonder if, so sometimes in these koans, when they indicate time or something like that, he realized it at midnight. Usually the time is a part of the answer. I kind of wonder if, like, the life he had been living for a year is itself the something undefiled.
Yes, I mean, one would like to think that. I agree. I think that's a good answer to this, that a year spent cleaning the toilets is discovered to be itself something that doesn't need to be cleaned, right? The danger in the language is I've discovered a place that is so pure it can't be violated, right?
And when I look at it, it seems, you know, I think that he's saying, when he says, I hit upon that which is undefiled as an answer, you know, he's saying, like, oh, this was a trick question. You know, like, there was never any reason to purify anything. So you were, you know, you were trying to fool me with that question.
Well, it's, they all are trick questions. If we go down the page a little bit, it gives a little longer version of the story where he says, you know, he went to his teacher's quarters and told him, I can answer. And the teacher says, say it. The master said, I have hit upon that which is not soiled. Whereupon the master hit him. You know, the teacher hit him. He then broke out in a sweat and bowed. And then the teacher gave him his approval. So maybe there's a two-step process here where first, he makes he has the more garden variety realization of feeling like he's hit upon a pure and perfect state, right? And he says, I hit upon pure mind, whereas upon the master hits him, which is a nice pun in itself. And it may be that in being hit, there is a shattering of this pure state as in any separateness, and it becomes one with being hit and one with everything else, like cleaning the toilets. Not so clear, but we could imagine that.
I like that idea, though, that he needs to be purified of his idea of purity.
Yes.
He's contaminated by it.
Yes, I think that's that's a kind of recurring trope in a lot of these stories, that people need to be purified of their purity, or get over their enlightenment, get over their attainment. I mean, you see that even in the dedication where it says, wisdom beyond wisdom. The idea is that this is wisdom that's not opposite to delusion. It's wisdom that is separate from the dichotomy of wisdom and delusion.
Then I don't know if the person is moving towards humanity or taking him or herself away from him in it.
Yes, I think that's the question, but you know that almost everybody sort of gets the problem and the solution backwards, you know, one way or another in these things. It's as if at first the solution looks like something transcendent, something that takes you away from your humanity. And that's a move that everybody wants to make. And it's a move that is sort of described in koans as getting stuck in emptiness, typically. Mm-hmm. Right? That it's this place where you don't have to sweat the particulars of anything, right? And so that's the great trap in spiritual practices. And Zen sort of flatters itself that it recognizes that as the trap where most, you know, other lesser vehicles treat that trap as the answer, right? As the thing to be attained.
And are they getting over their enlightenment? Are they getting over their idea of what this enlightenment is?
Well, I think that's the question where people really end up, and I don't think I believe that there is a universal place they all end up, you know. I think who knows what's been sold as what over the years. I think that I think I've encountered many teachers who want to play I've got it, you don't, and they I'm not sure they've gotten over their enlightenment. So who knows.
I wonder if the basic fear is mortality?
Well, impermanence. Mortality is a pretty good example of, impermanence. There is always this sense of, is this going to get me out of the human condition, however I conceive of that, you know? I mean, the original story of Shakyamuni is that, you know, as a young man, he says, sickness, old age, and death are absolutely unacceptable. I have to find the answer to this, right? Well, good luck with that, kid. You know, I mean, so in some sense, he, what kind of answer does he find, right? I mean, it's, on one hand, he comes full circle and sees these things as inescapable, but in some way empty, as not things to be warded off. In another sense, he creates for his followers a form of life that embraces the things that he starts off being afraid of. The form of life is one of that embraces impermanence and dependency, right? You'll have no home, no relationships, no possessions, and be utterly dependent on living by alms.
Don't try to accumulate an arsenal against impermanence.
Right. That's right. Don't try to build a wall against impermanence.
I found that
it's a little funny. I mean, I always call that if you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose solution. If you really see impermanence, you could see it as well at the palaces in the monastery. It's a lot. And it's not clear to me that the temptations are not greater than the other, you know. But it's what does it mean to enact a realization of that? Is there a lifestyle that itself enacts that realization? Right. I see. It's impermanence and interdependency are not truths only found in monasteries. It's the reality of everybody's life everywhere, right? So it's sort of by definition the realization that you can find in the midst of everyday life. Does living your regular life constitute an ongoing denial of those things, and only by living a ritualized life of asceticism are you enacting that realization? I'm not so sure of that. Yeah.
Well, what occurred to me before was that, you know, it's sort of beware of any concept of the absolute, or that there's an end to you, well, I guess an end to your suffering, but it keeps going, you know, there is, it's hard to articulate exactly, but just, it keeps going. You can't stop.
It doesn't stop. It stops in the sense of, there's an end to that feeling of being a day late or a dollar short. There's an end to the feeling of something wrong, something missing. But it's not as if that's a state itself that you get and you never lose. Mm. It's more like you go through lots of circumstances without particularly adding that narrative of lack to all of them, right? It's cleaner.
I think when you stop trying to instrumentalize each little thing, then you can have more of that. And I've found it helpful to have other things going on in my life to sort of distribute the project of protecting myself from impermanence, so that I can catch a little glimpse of that, like, you know, in sitting, like, it's a relationship that'll fix me, so I can just sit, you know, and then I leave that alone, and then,
that's okay.
Well, I think that's right, you see, you get a different perspective on it when you're doing it in different arenas.
Yeah, I could just do this for fun, and then, and then you do that with the other thing, and it's like...
But
and you can sort of watch, the different candidates for that permanent state, and I think love is one that we sort of nominate very often.
To fix things,
or to be a permanent, unchanging state that will be the solution to things, right?
Yeah, it's important to work on lots of solutions to impermanence at once.
But that is already defensive.
But like if you think about it,
you're just going to move it to another room. If you drop it here, it just means you've smuggled it over there. Right?
But you don't want to wake up at like 60, the abbot of some monastery, having missed out on love.
Right. I mean, that seems, there are a lot of people who seem to have had that moment and decided to do something about it. And what they do about it is often not skillful and not helpful to everybody else in the monastery, but they...
midlife crisis.
Right. It's I've tried to solve all my problems in this one area, and that doesn't work well.
So a lot of traditional Buddhist, you know, teachings talk about like renunciation in some form or other. Even in a lot of these stories, like here it says he gave up doctrinal studies at 19 and entered the monastery. So there's a lot of, in some way or other, giving up like this project, you know, some project that you've invested yourself in, or your identity, or the meaning of life, if not your possessions.
Yeah, you know, usually you get the sense that people, you know, in the monastic story, they realize that doctrinal studies is a dead end, and so they have to go actually enter the monastery, right? Renunciation is sort of a funny idea. I think you could certainly take the attitude that you don't have to renounce anything because you're going to lose it all anyway. Right? I mean, all you have to do is to stay awake and honest to the fact that it's all slipping through your fingers, and you do not have to renounce a thing. Right?
Renounce what? There it goes.
Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, again, the danger of literal renunciation is that you move the problem into a different room, mm-hmm. right? Like Chris was saying, that you sort of create a literal act of renunciation of physical possessions, but what do? You become very preoccupied with the preservation and meticulous enactment of a set of rituals and the way something is mm-hmm. run, and you know that it's all has to go just so, right? If you're going to be attached to controlling things, which is what, you know, renunciation is a form of, I'm not going to try to have or control stuff, mm-hmm. right? But if psychologically you're organized around control, mm-hmm. Becoming a monk, let alone becoming an abbot, is not going to, free you from the being a control freak, mm-hmm. right? You'll just be a very tight-ass monk, right? you can't renounce a psychological organizing principle. You can try to move into a situation that goes against the grain of it, but most of the time you're going to have to be savvy to the fact that you're going to try to collude, have the situation collude with whatever it is you do otherwise.
So we don't change ever our organizing principles?
Well, they do change, but they change. They don't. You can't change them through an act of will. Mm. And they have to evolve in a certain kind of setting. The problem with renunciation is, in a sense, that it is a it's an act of will. It's as mm-hmm. if the big thing here is to make this choice. Now the question, you know, what matters is to make a choice to put yourself into a situation that's going to act on you and slowly be some kind of either. And here the metaphors get interesting. Is it going to be a grindstone? Or is it going to be a solvent? You know, I mean, what is it that's going to, what kind of chemical or physical reaction is going to happen to these organizing principles, mm-hmm. right? Are you going to kill your ego? Or are you going to just give it a...
dilute it?
You know, give it a happy retirement. You know, mm-hmm. give it a watch and a handshake. And say, thank you, you've done your job, you know, there's not much for you to do around here anymore, right? That would be a nicer way to think about it, right?
You know, as I understand, it comes to a point that the change happens, the surrender happens, and you don't even see it. It's just gradually transformed.
Yeah. I think for a lot of people that is the experience of something just lets go.
Yeah.
Where the sense of
the energy,
like where you feel like I've always on my guard, mm-hmm. and at one point I just realized I've relaxed, mm-hmm. right? It's like for years I thought I had to try to impress you people, and now suddenly I just don't have to bother to do that. I can trust that things will just be all right, mm-hmm. right? That there's some mm-hmm. way in which something that consciously or unconsciously you're always trying to do, to sort of be on good behavior, to impress people, to stay safe, to whatever that sort of habitual stance is, you can relax out of it.
But that relief, that moment of relief was really a product of a long process.
Yeah.
Perhaps unconscious. Well, probably unconscious.
You're cleaning the bathroom.
I don't think we know. I wonder if this is something we age into. I wonder if it's like a tree growing or something.
Well, some people it's like that. Some people it's very sudden. Some people it's very gradual.
Sometimes
it happens when you're 25, and sometimes you're a crotchety 85-year-old, and it never happens. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's but some of it may be you just mellow out.
But the thing is, you needed to know your organized principle. I mean, you needed to realize it. Sometimes we don't, because it's so part of us that you just go with that.
True. Sort of the presumption of psychology is to become more conscious of them is to help loosen them up. Traditionally, Zen had no interest whatsoever in becoming conscious of that. Right. It's as if we will act on these things through discipline and ritual.
Actually, the way renunciation was presented to me at the temple was that it's not to renounce things, but to show you how you react to not getting your way and your relationship to your way. Like, I think, like, religions include things like Lent, you know, for this reason, to, like, you know, keep us honest about how flexible we think we are about letting things slip through our fingers.
Yes, I think there's certainly a big part of the monastic ritual is of not having your way, of just how I like it is irrelevant, right? There's a rule for it, and that's what you do, right? And there's something that I think is very good about a certain kind of you just stop fighting against discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when Choko used to organize her session so that everybody just slept in the zendo at night. You know, you didn't have you would just have your sleeping bag and your stuff, and you'd put a few zabatons together, and you slept in the zendo, right? And there were always sort of an excess of 40 people in Sesshin. It would be distributed through a few rooms, but you were in a room that was always too crowded, where somebody snored, and where there was a big scramble to get to the bathroom in the morning, right? And, she got more famous and people wanted to, build up things, people said, shouldn't we go get a bigger building and a bigger temple and that place in the country? And, her basic attitude is no, it should be the fact that it's all, inconvenient is the point, right?
Was the end of the story? She kept the way it was?
They ended up buying the buildings next door to expand a little bit, mostly to give her a separate living space when she got older and to have more office space and things like that. But the basic model was that Sodo, FD model of sleep in the Zendo and live in one room and trained that way, which is nicer when you're younger than, you know, in our age. But
but
how much of it's still that way? Gail just was out there, so she could tell the story.
When I was just out there, there was maybe 30 people total on the sashin, and a lot of them were spending the night at their homes, you know, so they get there at 6:30 in the morning and leave at 9:30 at night. And those of us who were staying there, the men stayed in the zendo, and I think there were like 7 of them, and the women stayed in the back house, Joko's old house. And it was like completely luxurious, and there were, you know, futons that you could sleep on, and I was alone in a room, and
unheard of.
She's sitting in her grave somewhere.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Elizabeth and Ezra are, they're in their 70s, so they're trying to organize something that's, you know, more relevant to an aging sangha. You know, not that they practice that way there anymore. And that's the other thing that I'm. And Joko, you know, I always, you know, Elizabeth and Ezra, they, you know, they'll tell me in terms of running these sessions that, you know, they don't sit there anymore. Joko never sat in the session.
Oh, she didn't?
No.
Why?
Where was she?
She was just the Dokusan.
And that was it? Where was she doing
but
the
in
rest
the beginning.
Of the time?
What?
In the very beginning, the first sitting or something.
Okay. Did she come in for the first sitting?
God.
I don't know.
Ezra and Elizabeth come in for
the first sitting? That might be nice. Maybe she was there for the first one. I don't remember. Usually there's some kind of opening and maybe she comes in, you know.
She very strikingly said in one of the recordings somewhere that she doesn't have to sit anymore. That this is really not for the same reason that you're all doing it, she said.
Yes, I think she felt like she's performing a service for people to have all, to do all this. And I largely feel that way. I don't... I wouldn't go off and do a bunch of, you know, sessions on my own anymore if I wasn't leading them.
Did you sit every day, though, still?
Mostly. I mean, not every day. I don't feel, make a big fuss about it. I'd like, if I'm on the weekend, I'll sit up for a half hour in the morning by myself or something, but I don't. I do it because I like it, and if I don't like it, I'll do it, you know, that's all. But it's a habit for me now. This is part of my life to be here, to sit with you all and to teach. For Joko, she really organized things so that she was there as the teacher. She would see 45 people in Dokusan, morning till night. I mean, she was, you know, that's hard.
It's harder than sitting.
And she used to say, you know, what was hard for her is that would just get her so wired up that she had trouble sleeping during the sessions, that it was just one intense story after another. Yeah. You know, people would always come in there with, you know, all sorts of stuff, you know.
Do you think that during sesshin with the meditation and, you know, the zazen, that is a regression, right? So the teacher really gets us in a regressed state.
We
get all the raw stuff out.
What do you mean by regression?
Regression is when you started to really act in ways that you don't have so much of a guard or a social becoming, maybe I would say in a simple way to express this, like a child, whatever. Unguarded.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I know child would sit through that shit, but it's you know, just get up. You know, I mean, it's like, but it's but there's certainly a way in which you become unguarded or just overwhelmed.
Well, you don't have your normal stuff that you use every day to cool
yourself
out. Yeah,
usually you just sort of, at some level, let go and go with it, right? You stop protesting it, and you just are on the conveyor belt, And you know, it's just like the cow going down the chute waiting for the big hammer to come by, get you upside the head.
I wonder why people are not attracted to the Zendo in the numbers that we want.
Put that on the website. I mean, there's certainly that aspect. But look, there is also the way in which I think for my generation, it was a very macho practice, and people did it the way they were mountain climbers. I mean, people are marathon runners. I mean, people really trained to be able to do this physically difficult and enduring exercise, and took great deal of pride in being able to sit in great pain for a long time until, you know, something snapped, you know, for better or for worse. But it was like being an athlete, right? And it was very macho.
Well, macho doesn't happen in a vacuum. Like, I would do that because I had Dharma brothers next to me.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you compete with your...
It was very competitive, and a lot of pressure to be tough and to do all of that, right?
I think the concentration piece was also very important, right? Like, to concentrate, to increase...
Yes.
We don't do this so much here, do we?
No,
we don't do that so much. I think that has its own benefits and pitfalls to it, but it really was that kind of sit in great pain, do mu, focus, and there is a way in which that can create brilliant dissociative experiences.
He needs opioids.
Did Joko get like people who didn't know what they were getting into when she got famous?
Well, the more famous you get, the more people are there because they've read your books, you know, and stuff like that. So, and the place was always full of refugees. I mean, that was basically what it was. Everybody there was there because there was some crisis at their home center, you know, and they came there to deal with it. You know, I mean, that whole place was like that. I mean, originally it was all these people who had left Los Angeles because of the scandals with Mizumi, right? And whether they had been personally involved with it, they had been part of a atmosphere where they had been suddenly disillusioned by that whole other place, and they were looking for an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the downside of that was the atmosphere in San Diego in the 80s was that everybody out there is really completely nuts, and that these people have screwed up, they have no idea what they're doing, and that we're this one little island of sanity, you know, while one place after another is imploding.
Crashing. Mm.
So she didn't create a very ecumenical atmosphere. It was a tad self-righteous.
Do you think so that you could concentrate on people with trauma, real trauma then?
Yeah, I mean, she was dealing with lots of people who were... you know, who had been sexually involved with teachers and all sorts of stuff. So, Zen centers are filled with traumatized people who come to Zen as a way to deal with it. So it's, it was a pretty motley crew of people, you know, myself included.
Huh? Not like here.
Yeah, like here.
I want to ask about sort of one passage kind
yes,
of late
please.
Late in this reading.
I'm
ruining the fun here. Toward the end of, well, about five paragraphs toward the end, Rujing also always used to exhort people just to sit, and he would tell them not to do these other things. And he always said, the beginning of Zen study is to have the heart of the way.
Mm.
Truly, even if they have some knowledge or understanding, those who lack the heart of the way cannot keep their understanding and eventually fall into erroneous views and become wild. They are outsiders sticking to Buddhism. What do you make of this?
Well, I think in a certain sense he's talking about secret practices, you know, and that that there's a way in which through ritual or through clinging to notions of purification or attainment, you lose the heart of the way and you get caught up in some crazy notions of what you're up to.
What does heart of the way mean exactly?
Where are you? I'm sorry.
What does heart of the way? I mean, he says that twice.
Yes. Well, that's sort of the koan of all this. What does it mean to not get? What's the opposite of getting caught up in all that stuff?
Not seeking.
Kazan's comment at the end. It says, "If you are like this, even if you have not yet understood it yourself, you will be an originally unsoiled person. Since you are unsoiled, how can you not be an originally clean, pure person?" See, so it says, even if you've not understood it, you will be an originally unsoiled person. It's sort of saying, if you have a kind of simple trust in Zazen and just sit, whether you realize it or not, you're fine. Right? And then that at some point will become clear to you.
Is it possible?
I think that's the dilemma. I think everybody sits for the wrong reasons, and so it's hard
but something
to
happens,
start
don't,
that way, right?
Don't you think something happens anyways?
Sometimes. Sometimes it happens. I think, you know, some people...
So that kind of suggests that you enact purity or defilement, right? Like you perform...
Yeah, that's he sort of... putting a Dogen-like spin on this by saying that Zazen itself is enlightenment, and whether you realize it or not, to engage in this practice in this form, you got it, right? And you may not realize it, but you're already...
But I remember in Catholicism, if you pray, yes, you know, I think in every religion, that is something else, that if you do... will be saved, or that's what Buddhists propose, it's Zazen. So you'll be transformed, you know. If you pray for God, God will listen to you.
That's the idea. It's just your whole notion of what being listened to or having God give a response evolves as you pray. So that, you know, instead of God healing your illness, God, you may feel that is God is with you in your suffering. That's a kind of very sort of different transformation of what prayer or God's presence means, right?
This feels very, what you were saying about just sitting, it seems to lead into Dogen. I mean, this is a precursor. I mean, you can see how his teacher was Ru Jing.
Well,
I guess.
Yeah, and so the historical question then is how much of that is being read back into Ru Jing.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, we'll see that with Dogen's next time. I mean, see if you can find it in. I guess it's in one of the maybe it's Steve Hine books or one of the other guys, but. The famous phrase of body and mind dropped off. You know, Dogen was Japanese, and he's sitting in this monastery in China where they're talking Chinese. And so there's a certain school that says, Dogen misheard the phrase and didn't understand what was being said because it was in Chinese. And he heard it as dropping off body and mind, But, you know, they're really saying, you know, drop off your laundry and, at the end of the day.
Well, whatever, it
worked. Yeah. Whatever it worked, you know. There's somebody who apparently says the whole notion, phrase of dropping off mind and body, as Dogen says, it never exists in Zhuzhen.
Certainly Shikantaza doesn't exist in Zhuzhen.
Well, again, it doesn't exist the way Dogen says it exists. It's whether he just simply put his own spin on something that was very different.
If you look at the saying, his record of what Zhuzhen taught, like he departs from, where one point the teacher says, Dogen, when you sit in Zazen, put your mind in the palm of your left hand. Mm-hmm. And Dogen, never, that's a very explicit concentration practice, right? And Dogen never taught that.
Yeah, and there are apparently independent records of Zhuzhen. Where his recorded sayings of him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exist independently of Dogen's stories. And so they don't correlate exactly 100%.
What is the body and mind dropping off of?
It says Zen study is the shedding of mind and body.
What does dropping it off mean? Right, that's right. What does that refer to? Well, how do you talk about that? I mean, in a certain sense, it means suddenly experiencing both as empty, or in this kind of case, suddenly seeing neither as pure or defiled. Right?
But there always seems that there's something behind that. Then who is?
That's the language of all this. That is, I think almost inevitably misleading. As if, body and mind drop off, and there stands the pure body of what, right?
Silence.
But isn't that what gets us into trouble, though? We think we understand that language, and we make some image of what that is, and we think we know what that is. And
I agree. I mean, to me, that's what I try to do talking about all this, is to sort of get it out of the level of woo-woo and see if we can find some plausible psychological equivalence, right? And not think that all of this results in the opening up of some big door into another realm.
Yeah. Well,
even though, real changes happen, but they happen, to real people in the real world. All right. Enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whatever the hell. Thank you. For the-